writers and readers. I'm Avery Brooks, and you're listening to the Western Colorado Writers Podcast, where we talk to writers about writing. I'm excited to welcome screenwriter and filmmaker Hank Braxton to the podcast today to talk about his work and some exciting local initiatives. Here's a little bit of background about Hank. Hank Braxton grew up in Fruta and Grand Junction, making home movies throughout school and eventually in the U.S. Army. After an honorable discharge and a short stint in film school, Hank moved to Los Angeles, where he descended into the struggle for over a decade, eventually writing and directing several movies and episodes of television shows. After moving with his wife back to Grand Junction in 2018, the couple has produced three feature films on the Western Slope, bringing in talents such as Michael J. White and Jeff Fahey while working with the local school curriculum to establish a film hub in Western Colorado. Hank has been nominated for several Emmy Awards, mostly lost, among other awards that were also mostly lost. Hank, thanks for taking the time to join us today and chat with us a little bit.
Sure, as long as people don't mind hearing from a loser.
I know you've won one Clio, so...
I've won some stuff, but you really do stop keeping track after a while. Like, you know, I guess if I won an Oscar or something, I'd probably keep that on the forefront of my conversations for a long time.
But... Yeah. Well, and you mentioned a little bit about success, so we might come to that a little bit later in our chat. So you're a child of the 80s, like myself, when some major cinematic feats were coming to the screen. And so I was curious, what was it that captured your interest and inspired you to try to make your own movies as a kid and then also later during your time in the Army?
Well, I mean, it's an interesting question because obviously there's a lot of things that, you know, inspire you and you draw upon later in life that don't necessarily right at the moment say, hey, make movies or hey, do your own writing. So it's like kind of a two-parter. I'd say the movie that spurred me to start making movies was actually Predator. It came out when I was like 7 or 8, and I just, you know, we thought it was so awesome and had a little camcorder and we were going to make Predator 2. Like, that was my big plan. So, you know, we have some green foresty area around here, and that was, to me, that was jungle enough. And then they were coming out with Predator 2. So I didn't make Predator 2. But the other part of your question is, like, you know, movies that inspired me and I drew upon a lot as I began creating stuff, you know, were the usuals: Star Wars, Ghostbusters, Terminator, Aliens, that kind of stuff.
Mm-hmm. Nice. And after attending film school in Denver, you made the move out to LA like many do, either New York or LA, to get their kind of foot in the film industry. And now you have a long list of credits under many different roles like writer, producer, and director. So can you tell us a little bit about what it was like getting started in Los Angeles and which of your skills you think contributed to the success you saw in getting involved in so many different projects out there?
You know, when you first start out, I was pretty low. I was production assistant, just, you know, working at a production company, doing whatever. When you're at that role, it's like a lot of times you're just like handling low level paperwork, carrying equipment, that kind of stuff. But I had a lot of skills from my experience in post-production because I'd been making stuff so long for myself. And I was pretty good with computers. I'm still pretty good with computers because it was an interest I had. So that allowed me to get good at Photoshop and After Effects and all this, you know, have all this knowledge for all these softwares. And so, I kind of rose up quicker than a lot of others because I had the ability to do this magic. You know, that's what like a lot of producers and stuff like, I think, kind of think of post-production. It's magic because it's so powerful, but they don't necessarily know how to do a lot of those things. Mm-hmm. So, I moved up quickly from that and, you know, started editing things and directing like little demos and pilots and eventually, you know, TV shows, and started producing things for a lot of these same companies. And at a point, you want people to stop thinking of you as the tech guy. Mm-hmm. Or tech person, like whatever you're doing. And in order to do that, you have to start doing whatever it is you want to do. So in my instance, I wanted to direct movies. You know, no one's going to like walk through the door with a golden ticket and be like, here you go, here's a budget and make your movie. They don't think of that. They call me when they need someone to fix their computer or fix their camera or edit something, that kind of thing. And so I put a movie together with some friends. We wrote a movie that was what we called very producible, which means, you know, you use stuff you have access to. So we were renting a house in Glendale, me and my roommates. We just thought, how do we tell a horror movie that all takes place in this house? Like, so let's come up with let's come up with some things that can keep them in there. And I think someone was like, oh yeah, we could have, you know, this bridal shower. you know, their bachelorette party. They're here and they're stuck inside because there's a storm. And I was like, well, that's, you're onto something. Like, I don't think a storm's that interesting, but I remembered reading a story years earlier about a train carrying like chlorine chemicals that like derailed in some small valley in America. And it, you know, got into the air immediately and made the air outside toxic, basically. And so these people were like stuck in their house for days waiting for rescue. And, you know, killed a bunch of farm animals and stuff like that. But I thought, like, why don't we take that concept and ratchet it up and make it, you know, a more deadly air toxin that kills you in a few minutes? You know, that's why they're trapped in the house. And, you know, you go outside and you start melting, you know, that's kind of fun. So that's how we came up with the movie Chemical Peel, the name of it. And once I had directed that movie and sold it to Lionsgate, you know, people thought of me as a director from then on. Mm-hmm. They didn't ask me to come be the assistant editor or, you know, the DIT, which is the digital imaging technician, which is what I did on Insidious. But I stopped getting calls for stuff like that. And then pretty soon movies started coming to me. Hmm. In fact, the last six movies I've done, they're not movies that I like, I'm going to sit down and write a movie and go make it. It's, you know, these companies will come to me and they'll say, hey, we need a movie that's got a dragon in it or dinosaurs, like which one would you rather do? And they need to be fighting soldiers. That's how a movie like Dragon Soldiers comes about. And then the follow-up after that, Jurassic Hunt, which is dinosaurs versus, you know, soldiers / hunter guys. You know, eventually stuff will start coming to you, but that's it. That's the hustle. That was kind of my path to getting where I'm at. And then eventually I was making these cheapo movies and I just thought, you know, my wife and I talked about it. Every time we go on vacation, we go to Colorado, you know, we can make this stuff in Colorado. Let's just move. Mm-hmm. And so we were fortunate enough to own a condo in LA and we sold it. And we moved back to Western Colorado and the movies followed. So now we make movies here and we're fortunate that that's been working out. I did not expect that to work out. I kind of thought that I'd move back here and like have to, you know, find another job or something, which is totally okay. I told her, I'd rather move back to Colorado at this point and like learn to be a plumber than keep editing or working on reality TV. And like, you know, with these cheap movies, we can keep doing those. Like, no matter what our job is, we can take time off now and then and do a movie. Mm-hmm. And the best part is like, at some point, like we'll just be making our movies. We'll make what we want to make. And that's the thing about budgets too. It's like the cheaper the movie, the more control you have. And the more money you start getting from people, the more you got to like take their opinions and, you know, put the things in there that they want and, you know, make their ideas. And sometimes that's great. And sometimes it, you know, just feels like a job.
Mm-hmm. I mean, I was going to ask about Chemical Peel a little bit later because you kind of got to this point where you and your wife had co-written this screenplay. And obviously from what you have just said, you're already in LA, you're doing different roles for other films and things like that. But you came to this choice of, do we make it ourselves or do we, you know, try to sell it? And so I'm just kind of curious if you can talk more about why you chose to make it yourself and then kind of that process.
I don't know. I think, you know, it's kind of similar to like, I made a movie called Return of the Ghostbusters back in 2007, you know, a full fan film with the props and everything. And I knew even then that we'll never be able to sell it. Like, that's not going to be allowed because it's copyrighted material. You know, we have to just put it on the internet for free. And even then, you got to hope that they don't shut it down, you know, like remove it from all the sites. But I did that because I was like, I just wanted practice. I wanted to make a movie with like low stakes and just not have that pressure on me. Chemical Peel is kind of the same way. And it just kind of happened. I just had friends who were like, hey, I want to put like $3,000 in. So we all put a little in. I think we spent like $12,000 making that movie, which is like ridiculously small.
Yeah.
But we just had a bunch of talented friends that were able to put in sweat equity, you know, because we're in Los Angeles and in Los Angeles, there's a lot of talented filmmakers and just talented. You know, when I say filmmaker, too, it's a generic term. I'm talking about everybody in the industry, you know, from your makeup artists to your visual effects artists, your sound mixers, directors of photography, directors, producers, writers, like all of it. You're just a filmmaker to me. You know, mm-hmm. You're just an artist. So I use that as a blanket term. So there's just so many filmmakers in LA. you know, you'd be surprised how many are just like the rest of us. Like, they might be really talented, but it's hard to break in. And sometimes you don't have a job in the industry that that's what you want to do. There's plenty of people that are waiters, or they work in IT, or this or that. You just need to make enough to keep your overhead paid for and live in LA and meet people. Mm-hmm. Eventually you meet enough people that can help you out so that you get to a point where you can make a movie for that cheap. And I think it's important to note on that, that you have to help other people out too. People remember that. Like, they remember the people that show up and put forth effort and, you know, aren't trouble.
Yeah. You know, there's a lot of people, I think, who want to write a screenplay, want to make a movie, that kind of thing. Maybe don't have those skills of like, okay, how do I take this myself into creating a film, right? And So there's that aspect of, I have to wait for someone else to come along, or I have to sell this to somebody who does have the skills. And so what is cool about your story and with your wife is that you all took the initiative and created that opportunity for yourself. I think about like Issa Rae, for example, who did it with Insecure, you know, and other shows of just, If people aren't hiring, just do it. You know, like, do what you're passionate about, show that you can do it, put it on YouTube or whatever. And then people see you as someone who can complete a project. And as you kind of said, now you're kind of known for being able to complete projects, and that's bringing in more and more work, and you're in this enviable position of the work is flowing to you, right?
So that's a really important point you bring up, actually. When they see you have the ability to complete a project at a certain level, there's an expectation of how that work's going to look. And, you know, I'll be honest, our stuff, you know, we make a lot of cheaper stuff. It's still better than it should be for that budget, but it's still like, no one's going to walk through the door right now and hand me an Oscar pending script. I'm moving my way up. You know, we're working our way up. We're out of the sci-fi lower stuff, and we've moved up a little. You know, there's all these different levels, but that can, you know, it can be intimidating to somebody that hasn't done any of it. But I will remind you all that we all started having done nothing. And the great thing is now is like, the technology is so advanced that you can get started. You know, you could shoot a short film on your cell phone, and you can write it, shoot it, you can edit it. Maybe you'll hate it when it's done. Maybe it's terrible, but you'll see it, and you'll see like, I want to make this, this, and this better. Mm-hmm. And then you can look up videos on YouTube and watch tutorials about how people did this, this, and this better. Mm-hmm. And then you apply that to your next short film and your next one and your next one. And then you get to a point where like, I've been making 5-minute films, and I want to make, you know, this script's 20 pages. It's going to be a 20-minute short. Mm-hmm. And then eventually you get to a point where like, you know what, we're doing a feature, and you know what, you can do a feature. You could, even if you have a full-time job, you spend 1 or 2 days of your weekend, and after maybe 6 months or less, you know, basically 20, 25 days of shooting. So you give up 20 to 25 of your Saturday, Sundays, and eventually you will have a feature and you can put it out there. You know, we're at a state where you can submit your movie to Amazon or Tubi or all these places. There are services called aggregators, like Distributor is one. I don't know if that's still a thing, but you can Google aggregators, like film aggregators. And what those sites do is they will take your movie and your poster art and anything else you've done. And for a fee, they'll get it on iTunes and Google Play and all those places for you.
Okay. Well, you know, that brings up the question of you and your wife moving back here to Grand Junction. I mean, I know you're from here. She's from Colorado. Is that right?
Yes, she's from Denver.
Okay. I guess I'm just curious if you're grateful for the time that you took in LA, of that move, those connections you made. But also now you're kind of in the state of trying to bring maybe the industry to people out here, where they don't have to necessarily go to New York or LA to kind of follow their dreams, but you're bringing in this educational opportunity for local people to follow that. So yeah, I guess I'm just wondering if I can formulate this in a question.
That's a, all right, get ready for a big answer.
Yeah.
That's a multi-part thing too, because first and foremost, there's the selfish reason that we're back here teaching film schools and, you know, helping kids out. And that's, we need to build a pool here. Mm. We need to teach people how to run camera and how to run sound and how to act and do all these things so that we can put them in our movies, because it's cheaper and easier to use locals than to fly people out from LA and New York all the time. Mm-hmm. Having said that, like, that'll never stop. Like, we're probably always going to have to get a DP from LA, you know, things like that, because DP is director of photography, by the way. I will shorten acronyms all the time. I'm just used to it. But the nice part about that is when locals work on our movies, you're going to work with professionals from the industry. Mm-hmm. They're going to come out here and they're going to work with us for a month. And they're going to see you. And if you're like someone that hustles and is reliable and you're cool, we've had a couple kids that graduated the film school here and moved to LA and called the people that they worked on the movie with and said, "Hey, I'm in LA." And those people said, "Hey, I'm doing a shoot on this thing next week. Why don't you come work on it?" And boom, their foot's in the door. They're now working professionals in LA. You know, that's our goal, especially for the film school kids. Like, we don't want to lose them, especially the ones that get really good at this stuff. But we do think it's important for them to go to LA for a while, especially when you're like in your 20s, like, and you want to be in this industry. If you're serious about this industry, you need to go to LA or New York or Atlanta for a while. Get that experience, meet people. Maybe you hate it. You can always come back to Colorado. And when you come back, you'll be even more valuable to the film community here. Mm-hmm. The one that we're trying to build up so that, you know, we don't have to go back out there. Like, you know, we did our time. We did our time in service. And, you know, now we're just living the dream here. We make monster movies in our home state, and it's great.
Yeah. Well, and so why was it that you chose Western Colorado? Was it to be close to family, or is there something you see as being really unique and prosperous for the film industry?
It's both. I did grow up in Grand Junction and went to Fruta Monument High School. So I'm from the area. I definitely have an affinity for it. But I never thought my wife would go for it because she's from Denver. And then she lived in Los Angeles. Like, she's not lived in small towns like this. But when we left LA, we decided we were going to stay in Fruta for, 3 weeks at an Airbnb before we go full on to Denver. Mm-hmm. And she just fell in love with it. And something about it felt right. We just saw a lot of opportunity here to make some changes with film and have an impact and do a lot here. And it's also just, it's just such a beautiful place. Like, you go 45 minutes in any direction and get to any kind of terrain you need, mm-hmm. Minus the ocean. But like anything else, any other type of location you need, it's here. So that's one reason we ended up here. And the other is, again, it's just intuition. I have a feeling about things now and then, and I've always kind of followed that. Hmm. It's what led me to Los Angeles. I ended up there because I got a film I did in film school, a short film, into a film festival in Boulder. And once it was accepted, they announced it like, "Oh, this is the first year we're going to be doing our festival in Hollywood." So I was like, "Let's go," to the people that worked on it with me. I was like, we might meet somebody out there. And sure enough, that's exactly what happened. It was just instinct. And I will tell anyone that when you have intuition and you trust your gut and it rewards you, you have to learn to keep doing that. And it can be really hard because it doesn't necessarily always seem logical. And anything you do like this is a bit of a leap of faith, right? Like, mm-hmm. You got to just go with it, see what happens. But, that's part of the adventure in life. I'm not saying like put all your money in Bitcoin. Be open to opportunity and change.
Mm-hmm. Well, and I think about like the boom that happened in Albuquerque, mm-hmm. with Breaking Bad and Better Call Saul and things like that. And so that terrain's very similar to our own. I argue that we have a more beautiful area here. But, again, Albuquerque is still like a big city compared to what we have here in Western Colorado. So there are some differences. But do you kind of, this feeling you're having about how things are changing, is it kind of a decentralization of the film industry?
Yeah, it's, it's interesting because I mentioned that technology earlier, and it's really, I hate using the word disrupt. It just seems like such a buzzword at the time, but that really is what's going on. And it's happening with a lot of industries, but I'm kind of an expert in the film industry, having worked in it. It's definitely happening to the film industry, not just because like cameras are so much cheaper. When you used to make a movie 15, 20 years ago, and you had to shoot on 35 millimeter, you'd drop $200,000 just on film and processing. Mm-hmm. So the entry barrier was much higher. And now, you can make a movie with a camera that costs $2,000 and a computer that costs $2,000, under $10,000 worth of equipment total, you can make a pretty good looking movie. And so that's kind of saturated the market. It's simultaneously the best and worst time to be a filmmaker. It's the best because you can do it for so cheap, but because you can do it for so cheap, everyone's doing it for so cheap. Mm-hmm. And so you really got to stand out from the noise. But the other good part that's happened is like the bandwidth that the internet has now. You can send so much larger files, and so you can work remote. Like you can edit anywhere and upload your stuff to LA or New York. And that's becoming more and more common, but they still typically are hiring people that like they worked with in person. You know, we're probably, you know, the longer we go, the more people will be able to get first time jobs just over Zoom. That will happen, but there might be a risk there in that, you know, it happened to the visual effects industry a long time ago, is that a lot of stuff gets outsourced, you know, goes to Pakistan or Bangladesh or these places, because those, you know, Americans can't work that cheap.
Right.
Like we can't, because our cost of living is so much. So it will open itself up to that, to like maybe maybe a lot of this editing work and things will start going there. So it's a double-edged sword. Mm-hmm. But if you meet the right people and you get close enough in a professional relationship, then you can work remote. You can work anywhere.
Mm-hmm.
But I will go back to, you should work on the ground in LA or New York for a while, because you need that experience, the good and the bad. It's hard, but it's rewarding.
Mm-hmm. So I was really excited to hear about you and your wife's plans kind of for making a film hub here in Western Colorado. Can you talk a little about her? She's an actress, writer, and producer, right? So you are kind of this like dynamic duo together.
Yeah.
And what are your goals for this film hub? I mean, what are you most excited to create here?
The thing that excites me the most is we're working on the education aspect. And she's created a magnet program. Like, it's very small. It's just a little film immersion thing that each of the high schools working with the Mesa County Library, and she'd have to, you know, tell you all the details, but you know, there's going to be a little short film immersion program at each of the four high schools that she's put together. And we're hoping that will feed into the college system that we have here. We have a good program at Western Colorado Community College. CMU is doing a lot of stuff as well, messing with like media and film.
Mm-hmm.
And we're hoping to eventually bridge those both and create a film program that churns out students that are ready to walk right into the industry.
Wow. And so you're doing it at both the community level through the libraries and the high schools, but also at the university level. Is that right?
Correct.
And so what about people who might be past, well, I don't know if there is a past university age, but might be later in their years and are wanting to get involved or learn new skills, but they might not be interested in, you know, signing up for a university class? Are there opportunities for them?
Absolutely. You know, I wanted to touch on that. There's no ageism with the industry itself, with the art form. Obviously, you know, when you deal with other human beings, they're going to have prejudices, but it doesn't matter if you're 14 right now or 74 or 84, you can run a keyboard and type stuff. You can get a camera. You know, if your hands are shaky, put it on a tripod, you know, buy a cheap little gimbal rig. Cell phones and GoPros are great. They have built-in image stabilization. Like, you can get your shots.
Mm-hmm.
Make it just a show to locals and friends at first. You know, that's how I started. I started making movies when I was in high school. And back then it was VHS, you know, this is the 90s. So I shot on VHS, I edited VHS, and that's how they played. And the only time, you know, anybody got to watch the movies are when we got together and watched them in a room. And that's really fun and really satisfying. And so I would encourage you to, you know, make your stuff, and you can put it on the internet and get your thumbs up and thumbs down, but you can also, you know, get a screening together.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the Mesa Theater likes to work with local artists. The Avalon does stuff. Go over to a friend's house and, you know, put a projector on the wall and, you know, get five or six friends together and have some snacks and drinks and watch all your little short films.
Mm-hmm.
It's a blast. And you don't have to be trying to get into the industry and make money and win awards to enjoy it.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, I would say if you can find happiness in just what you're doing and stop looking up, you know what I mean? Like, we're always, everyone, and in this industry, I see it too. Like, I see filmmakers that are up ahead of me and they're just looking up. They're not looking back at me and being grateful for what they got. They're just like, they're looking at that next level they got to get to. Mm-hmm. And when they get to that, they'll be happy. But if you think that ascending a ladder is what's going to make you happy, then you're missing the point, and you're not going to find that. You need to just find happiness in what you're doing and just be like, hey, this was great. This was really cool. I'm glad I did that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and that's something I had to learn. Because I fell into that when I was first in LA. You know, I got to get into Sundance, you know, or one of these big festivals. You know, I want to get 500 likes on my Facebook post for it. You know, like we all see that and want that kind of validation. But eventually you learn, like, I'm really happy with the stuff I made. There's, you know, there's fun there. I've had moments, you know, I watched a movie in a theater with that I made with my dad and he was proud. You know, I watched a movie, you know, in a theater with my mom and she really liked it. I've never seen her react like that. I've been making movies for, you know, all this time. And this was the first time she saw something happen in that movie and it clicked, you know. Wow. It took until I was 40 and she was 70 for her to see this moment and just be like, very good, you know. And it's like, so you find those moments in your life just doing it and getting that enjoyment. And you just got to remember, like, it doesn't, at the end of life, it doesn't matter how much money or awards you have. Like, we're all going in the same box or whatever it is. It doesn't, you're not taking it with you. Mm-hmm. And in 100 years from now, no one's going to remember, you know, all these filmmakers that are winning Oscars. You know, if you look back 500 years ago, you know, what writers do we remember outside of like William Shakespeare? Like, what names have transcended that industry?
Right.
What names have transcended the modern filmmaking industry? You know, you got the people that are hot now, you know, Spielberg, that name will probably last, but you can't get caught up worrying about what your legacy is going to be. Hmm. I think this applies to everything in life, not just film, but you can be a positive force in someone's life. You know, you can just be that little spark that goes around and spreads happiness, and that should be enough for you. Like, you know what I mean?
Yeah. Well, I think it's also interesting that you can come back here to like Grand Junction and have the experience that you do and still be sought out after, right? I think everyone's definition of a success is a personal one, but I do think you're right that, you know, we see the Netflix successes, we see the blockbuster films. And so from the outside, that's like the standard, right, of what people are trying to go for.
Well, I want to point out on that note, just briefly, there's plenty of people that are looking at me right now and you're like, wow, look at all those movies you've done and this and that. And I can tell you, I've learned after doing so many of them that it hasn't changed me. Like I haven't gotten, you know, there's not been a single success that I'm just like, oh, it's over. I've done this. I've done that. You'll always move on to the next thing. You're always working. I would say outside of like monetary change, like, yeah, obviously if I made something that sent me $100 million check, that would change some things, mm-hmm. but I don't think it's going to like change who I am. Actually, on that note, $100 million, I don't even know what I would do with that amount of money. I'd probably give a lot away, actually build that school, free tuition for everyone in Western Colorado, that kind of thing.
But there you go.
My point is just having won lots of awards and made lots of films. I can tell you like it doesn't change you.
It's a good point. You're putting some like 40-year-old wisdom here, which I definitely appreciate. Yeah. And I guess, you know, one thing you mentioned in your writer's night talk that I was hoping you might be able to kind of lay out for people who weren't able to make it is just there's a bit larger of a landscape to this film industry than people on the outside might realize. You had kind of talked about different markets and things like that. So can you talk a little bit about that and it gets back to the idea of like, what is success, you know, and like, what is selling your movie, that kind of thing.
Do you mean landscape, like how movies are made or who's like working in the film industry or?
Well, more you had talked about, you know, it doesn't have to be on Netflix, but there was like European markets and you can be sold there versus, you know, having relationships through distributors, things like that.
Yeah, it is definitely a relationship business. When I said earlier, you can get your movie out there. I mean, you totally can. If you want to make money on it, you need to start knowing some people. Either you make something remarkable or you know people. I could sell my movie right to, you know, I could probably sell a movie to, I don't know, we'll call it one of the streaming shows. What are like Crackle? Let's say Crackle, for example. Is that still a thing? I don't know.
I'm not sure.
I could probably sell a movie to Crackle, say for $20,000. And I'm just throwing a number out there. However, if I took that same movie to a sales representative or sales agent who goes to lunch with the guy from Crackle and maintains a relationship and they know each other, I would probably get $100,000 for that same movie. You know, the sales agent's going to take his fee. Everyone's going to take their fees, but I'm still going to end up with way more money than I would have if I went directly to them. So obviously the solution is for me to have lunch with the guy from Crackle and cut out that middleman. You know, that's the idea, but you know, it's relationships. You have to build those. And I have relationships with certain parts of the industry and not others. So you gotta use what you got.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, I wanted to say that when you sell a movie, you know, even, you know, a low budget one, typically you get $100,000. And again, I'm just throwing numbers out that are easy to digest. So if you sell your movie to North America for $100,000, now you got to go sell it to all these other territories. The whole rest of the world is all territories. France is a territory. Maybe you get another $40,000 there. Germany, maybe they give you 30. UK, maybe another 40. Maybe France only gave you 10K because your movie has too much gore in it and they don't like that. China won't buy your movie at all because it's got ghosts in it and they don't like things with ghosts. So there's a lot of stuff. There's a lot of work to do to squeeze every drop out of a movie that you can. If you make a good enough movie and you sell it to a big enough company like Sony or something, you have a chance to maybe sell worldwide rights. And they just write you a check for $1 million for your movie. And that's it. They own it for the entire world distribution. And that only happens when a movie is good. If it's just decent or low budget stuff, you've got to parse it out to all those different places. But a good movie will sell in every territory right away. And so they want to go make that money. So you just get one check.
Okay. I appreciate that. And I think a lot of interest when at Writer's Night, and probably for a lot of people kind of listening in on this, are maybe they're fiction writers and they want to write a screenplay, or they just want to write a screenplay. And so I was curious if you can kind of talk about how those two things differ, fiction writing and screenwriting, and then also some resources or tools you would recommend to an aspiring screenwriter.
Well, fiction writing, when you're talking about just like short films or novels,
mm-hmm.
you have fiction and nonfiction. Well, screenwriting is the same thing. Screenwriting is just a more technical writing with less descriptive text in it. So like you're not painting as clear a picture typically because you're saving room for the dialogue.
Mm-hmm.
It's all about the dialogue and the stage direction, like what happens. You know, scripts can be fiction or nonfiction too. We've all seen, you know, based on a true story or, you know, a biopic that this is a true story. I guess you could count that as nonfiction as far as screenwriting goes. If you're writing fiction, I'll talk about that because that's what I know about. There's a lot of resources to get you going. There's a website called Studio Binder that I usually steer newbies towards that will tell you everything you need to know. They have tons of like tutorials and knowledge, and there are formulas. You know, scripts have formulas. You probably hear like something's formulaic.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you know that this is going to happen and this is going to happen and this and that. And, you know, 2/3 through the movie, the heroes are going to be really down on their luck at their lowest point, but then they'll come back and they'll triumph. And that's what feels so satisfying to the audience. And no matter how many times the audience has seen this formula, it always feels good. So basic movies will follow a formula. And these formulas are available online. Again, I would start with Studio Binder. And if you can follow their pathway to writing a script, you know, you learn that, the ins and outs of that. Eventually, you can start breaking those rules, you know, as with anything in art. You know, learn the rules, learn how to do things the quote unquote right way. And when you know those rules well enough, you know how to break them cleverly. And so when we see movies that are like, oh, that was so clever, that twist or this or that, it's clever because that writer has written a lot of stuff that was formulaic and they know the tropes. They know all those things so well that they know how to manipulate and break those rules just right. I hope that answered your writing question.
Yeah. And I feel like that's a lot of the advice I got as a writer starting out was you need to learn what the rules are before you break them, but don't start out breaking them because then that's right. Just a mistake.
I mean, yeah, it's hard to break rules when you don't understand them.
Right.
I mean, you could just get lucky. Mm-hmm. And you know what? On that too, I just want to encourage everyone, like, you don't have to jump out of the gate trying to win awards. Just tell the story you want to tell. You know, that's my number one lesson to the film students that I teach here. And I tell everyone is no matter what you do, make what you want, because you're not going to make everybody happy. Like, it doesn't matter how good your movie is. Someone's going to say it's the worst thing they've ever seen and you should never be allowed behind a camera again.
Mm-hmm.
And no matter how bad you think your movie is, somebody will get something out of it and they'll be like, hey, that had an impact on me. So just make what's in your heart and what you want to see, and it will be genuine. And those people that it does connect with, that'll be a real connection. And, you know, that's what art's all about, right? You're trying to establish a connection with your audience. You're trying to inspire something or, you know, strike an emotional connection. That's what it is. That's art. It's emotion.
Mm-hmm. And you talked a little bit during Writer's Night about the fact that you've kind of learned the ropes of writing and are a pretty strong writer at this point. So I was wondering if you would be up for sharing some tips of how to make a screenplay a strong screenplay.
Well, the key is the first 10 pages, really. You've got to hook the reader. Especially in Hollywood, they have people that just read scripts for a living and write what they call coverage, which is just a one-page synopsis of what happens in the script, what the script's strengths are, what its weaknesses are, and if they recommend it being made. Like, that's how quickly you're judged. And in a lot of cases, if it's just not good after 10 pages, it doesn't matter how great the rest of the script is, because they're never going to see it. That thing is closed and thrown in the burn pile. Like, and then when your movie gets made, you need that first 10 pages to be great because, you know, it's a streaming world now, right? How many times have you started a movie and if it's terrible, like 10 minutes into it, you bail?
Right.
You know, it's not a blockbuster night anymore where you got two movies to watch for the whole weekend. And no matter how bad they are, you're sticking with them because there's nothing else on but broadcast television. You've got it. You really have to fight for that audience these days. To touch more directly on your question, how do you make it a great script? I mean, well, that's subjective too, right? Like, somebody thinks the script for Transformers is amazing and the script for Saving Private Ryan is terrible.
Mm-hmm.
Those people are out there. But I would say the most important part of writing a good script, I would say, is good characters. Characters that we know who they are. We know what their dynamic is. We know what the characters want. And by the end of the script, we find out what the characters actually need. And so the difference between those two things is, you know, I like to cite Star Wars because everyone's seen Star Wars. Han Solo is a great character because he wants money. You know, he wants to pay off these bounty hunters and keep being the bachelor guy he is. That's what he wants. But by the end of the movie, he finds that he needs real friendship and that that's more important than money. And so he has an arc. And that's part of writing a great character, is they have an arc. We like to see characters fail and then triumph. On a more personal level, we like to see characters grow. We like to see redemption. You know, we like to see these things. And so write great characters, and the plot doesn't matter. It doesn't matter if they're rescuing the princess or going to prom. It doesn't matter. If the characters are great, the audience is with you. Now, if the characters are great and they happen to be doing something cool, like blowing up a space station, all the better.
Do you have like a scene that you refer your students to, of like one where they really did it well, both in writing and in the direction of the scene?
I mean, there's so many. Yeah. There's so many great scenes. You can just pop open YouTube and type in best scenes or this or that. And again, it's subjective. And it's like, what kind of scene are you trying to show somebody? You're trying to show somebody something that has great drama and tension in it. You know, someone's hiding. Is it a scene with a great fight scene and great action and great choreography? Is it something with really great subtext? There's tons of scenes. Everybody listening to this right now probably thinks of a great scene in their favorite movie. And that's how I roll. And it just depends on what we're talking about. I'm a big believer in talking. I'm not instructing students. I don't like to give I don't know. What do they call it when everyone just sits in there and like you just talk? You know what I mean? Where they're
a monologue
in the auditorium, everyone sits there and the professor just sits down in front and blah, blah, blah. And you have to just take notes.
Yeah.
I don't really learn well that way. And I don't think most people learn well that way. I talk and I ask them questions and I like to hear what they're thinking. Like, what do you like? Okay, let's talk about that scene. Pull up a scene from that movie. Let's dissect it.
Mm-hmm.
Like, and let's talk about what makes it great and what we like about it. And then let's get out the camera and see if we can, you know, match that same camera movement. Let's get out the lights and see if we can light it the same way.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and then I'll talk to him about the actor, like what the actor is doing. You know, it's a language. And I wasn't great at spotting good acting, and I still don't know if I'm great at it. You know, I certainly feel that I'm better at spotting great acting and great writing and, you know, this and that, but it's a language. You have to experience a lot of it to get better at it. It's the same thing with like a good technical example is lighting, you know, film lighting. Lighting is a language. Like you use light to carve a 3D image in what is a 2D medium. Mm-hmm. You know, like when you see flat lighting, you know that it doesn't look good. It looks cheap. It looks whatever. You don't necessarily know why if you haven't studied lighting, but it took me 20 years of like making movies and this and that before I got to a point where it's like, I can look at a scene now and know basically what kind of lights they used, where they're placed off camera. Mm-hmm. You know, I can read that now. And it was foreign to me. It was a foreign language to me for a long time that I just relied on the crew to, hey, get this lighting right. Mm-hmm. And so like, you know, practicing with that kind of stuff, it feels good after a while. That's all I'm saying. It feels good to like, to learn and get better.
Well, and of all the roles you've done in the production of making a movie, writer, producer, different effects and things like that, director, is there one role that you love the most or that really kind of speaks to you that you feel maybe is the most successful or the, you know, the most fulfilling part?
The most fulfilling, like, filmmaking role?
Yeah, like when you complete a project, like maybe the directing just hits your heart in a different way than maybe writing the screenplay does or something.
Of course, I'm like, the directing's the best part of my movie.
Is it?
Yeah. There are times where you're feeling a little saucy, where you're like, yeah, I'm the best. I put this whole thing together. This is all me. But mostly, honestly, and I tell everyone that works with me this because it's true, I'm grateful to have had all these great people just doing little things. There's so many little things that people do that you appreciate, that the movie wouldn't be as good without that. And like, obviously, there's the acting and the camera work and the lighting and the sound work and the special effects. All that stuff is obvious. But I also really appreciate the people that just get stuff plugged in and moved around and they're there. I need someone to go get the van and go pick up this actor and get them here. And our food today was really great. I really appreciate the people that are keeping us fed because mm-hmm. like you can't work 12 hours a day and focus on directing and moving the crew. If you're not eating, you know, you'll get sick. Right. You'll have headaches and nausea. Like you'll melt down. So I'm super grateful on my movies to everybody that does every little thing. Like I am in awe of them usually. Like, I'm so grateful for you guys just giving up your time, you know, and it's not like a lot of pay, but you know, thank you for helping me do this. It's great. And you know, when I watch other people's movies, I can see the great stuff that's on screen. I know that those people are plugging in things and stuff behind the scenes, but my respect for those films is different, you know. When I see a big expensive movie, it's like I appreciate, you know, the editing or the effects or the acting, you know, the things that are apparent that are right there. Mm-hmm. And that's the thing too. You know what? The grass is always greener, right? So when you see other people's work, it's always amazing. It's always, how did you do that? And like, you know how they do that because you do it too, you know, like, but yeah, I will tell you that, I've gotten better about it, but I've seen, you know, I see movies now and then that are just like, they're so good. I'm like, I'll never be this good. And that's okay. I have a role to fill. I have a niche that I fill, a certain type of thing that I make, and maybe I can learn some little things from those big, amazing movies. But, for the most part, I know my position. I know my role.
I just keep thinking of all the parallels you've mentioned between writing and then making movies. You know, like when you get started with writing, you read someone who's just masterful and it makes you not want to try anymore because you're like, I'll never get to that place, you know. But we all are different.
You see someone doing what you want to do and so good at it and you think that you'll never do it. And listen, you can always outwork talent. Talent is just a shortcut for people. You know, it's a cheat code. But if you put in the time and you learn the skills and you hone your craft, you can outwork talent. And also a lot of it is luck. And by that, I mean, like, there's so much that goes into making a hit movie. And so much of it is out of your control. Like, because you come up with a movie concept or you start a movie, well, it's going to be a year to 18 months before your movie comes out. And who knows what the world's going to be like what audiences are going to be receptive to,
right?
Like what's going to be hot, what's going to be changing pop culture at that moment. You know, what, maybe the actor in your movie is nobody, but in between you editing your movie and it coming out, they also came out in this hit TV show. And now everybody wants to see what movie they're going to be in. And your movie just happens to be coming out and that propels it and makes it a hit. Or, you know, a good story I have from some friends of mine, they made a movie back in 2019 and it was ready to come out in 2020, And that's when, you know, COVID hit and everything was shut down, right? All the theaters were shut down. And so their movie came out at a time when they just, horror movie, they took it to some drive-ins. They started booking it at drive-ins here and there. And pretty soon they made, I don't know how much they made. It's like $1 million or something. These two guys that are just like you and me, like making 60,000 a year or 40,000 a year, whatever they're doing. Mm-hmm. And now just because of timing, like if it was before COVID, you know, their movie probably would have made some money back and this and that, but you know, it really found an audience because of that. And now they're doing bigger stuff. They signed on with some agency and they've got representation and, you know, it's timing. Mm-hmm. And another thing that can happen that might break your heart is you might put everything into a movie or script and do everything right and make us, you know, a good movie. And it doesn't really go anywhere because of the timing, you know, like right. Audiences weren't ready for it. Maybe it was ahead of its time, whatever it is. And you can't get down on it, you know, be happy that you have a copy of it on your shelf and you can watch it forever and share it. And who knows, maybe it'll hit in 5 years, but mm-hmm. like you gotta move on and do the next one.
I'm just thinking how lucky your students are because you just have so much wisdom coming through in addition to, you know, important information that will help them with their careers and things. But so I had a question for you. You seem to make a lot of films that are like at the intersection of horror and sci-fi, like Snake Out of Compton, which is about like 85% of my nightmares in the form of one full-length film.
You're afraid of snakes and hip hop?
Yeah, that exactly.
Hip hop is scary.
So my question was, do you see yourself kind of moving forward with that genre mix in the future, or do you see it more of a blend and working with all these kind of up and coming artists in the valley?
I love making schlocky dollar bin Walmart movies. Like, it's fun. Like, it's like, you know, have a drink, hang out with your friends and watch this stupid movie on a Friday night and laugh, you know. Mm-hmm. But I've got some serious films coming up too. We're in early development with some serious horror films that will have higher budgets, you know, hopefully go to some bigger platforms. And yeah, I yearn to make that kind of stuff too. Mm-hmm. But I will say that I love sci-fi and horror. I'm sure whatever I make is going to be in those genres. And then I love comedy. So it's fun to like mix that in now and then, or action, you know? So it'll probably always be a mix of that. I don't think I'm going to be making a Christmas movie anytime soon or romantic comedy. I wouldn't even know where to start. Mm-hmm. Doesn't mean I don't like romantic comedies. There's some that I've enjoyed, but you know, I kind of make the stuff that I grew up watching. And when I went to the video store as a kid, I went straight to the horror aisle. Like that was so cool. You know, Freddy Krueger's rad, you know, the Terminator's awesome, you know, et cetera, et cetera. You know, the higher the body count, the better. That's how I was as a kid. But you know, I've grown to love all kinds of movies, but you know, that's probably my strength because deep down, you know, that's what I grew up with. And you know, those are the comic books I grew up reading. You know, Dark Horse made Aliens and Predator comics in the late 80s and early 90s. And so when the movies weren't being made, there were comic books. And so I would read those stories. And on that note, I'll tell you that reading so many comic books probably helped my eye when it comes to framing things. So if you're interested in doing camera work, I'd say check out comic books too. They really frame action well. And if you can shoot a movie that looks like a comic book, like you're in business.
Mm-hmm. That's a cool recommendation. I know you mentioned that you guys have you've already done 3 feature films since moving back here in 2018, and you have one more on the docket that you said, I think, is starting up in November. Is that right?
Yes.
Okay. So I was curious, for people who are interested in getting more involved or, you know, learning these skills locally, can you talk about what opportunities are coming down the line here in Western Colorado for people?
Well, we definitely need people that can work behind the scenes and don't mind, you got to run and pick up sandwiches, or I need someone to just hold the boom mic or move some sandbags. But we've also got, you know, some acting opportunities. And even though like most of the big roles are filled, you know, we have zombies and we have soldiers. And so we need people to come out and either kill soldiers or get killed by zombies, you know, have a good time. Some of those positions are paid, but you know what, you got to know what you're getting into, which is you're going to be on set for 10 to 12 hours. A lot of it's going to be sitting around doing nothing and just like talking to other people. And then you're probably going to get covered with green glowing goo.
So what is the best way for people to kind of keep up with the work that you're doing or to hear about opportunities or events happening locally?
Well, I have a lot of personalities based on where you find me on the internet. You can email me, and that's pretty professional. And I will talk to you as much as I can, and or I will put you in touch with our production manager who will get you scheduled and get you on the movie. And you can email me at hankbraxton@gmail.com. Pretty simple. You can follow me on Twitter and read my lame jokes and occasional announcements that we're doing a film, but I don't really like to talk about myself a whole lot on social media. I don't know. I know a lot of filmmakers, that's all they do is promote. And that works for some people. That gets them more work. I just don't really like promoting myself a whole lot, honestly. But I, you know what? I'll try. If you follow me on Twitter, I'll try to put out announcements that, hey, we're about to film. You know, I can't wait to get my 3 likes on this post. You know what I mean? I'm on Facebook too. And these days I pretty much only try to stay Facebook friends with people that are local. Mm-hmm. I want to get on Facebook okay, strike that. I don't want to get on Facebook, but it's part of the business. Like, I've got a network, and when I do get on there, I prefer to see people posting stuff from Western Colorado. So, mm-hmm. But yeah, I would say Twitter is probably the best way to find me. And I'm at Braxton Film, and Braxton is spelled Braxtan Film. So Braxton Film, all one word. That's where I tweet most of my nonsense.
Okay, that sounds great. Well, Hank, thank you so much for sitting down with us today. It's so much useful and helpful information, and I wish you and your wife the best of luck with the film hub.
Thank you. And you know, you reach out too. Like, come out and be a zombie. It's a good time.
The Western Colorado Writers Podcast is the official podcast of the Western Colorado Writers Forum, a nonprofit organization based in Grand Junction, Colorado. The Forum's mission is to foster a rich and diverse writing community on Colorado's western slope that invites participation from diverse cultures, customs, and life experiences. The Forum hosts Writers' Night presentations at the Grand Junction Center for the Arts on the first Tuesday of every month, where local and national writers give presentations on their craft. Sign up for the Forum's free newsletter at westerncoloradowriters.org. You can also find us on Facebook at Western Colorado Writers Podcast. If you have thoughts or suggestions for the podcast, please drop us a line at westerncoloradowriterspodcast@gmail.com. This podcast is made possible through the support of the Grand Junction Commission on Arts and Culture.
Yeah.